On the final day of Peter Schiff's radio show, host Tom Woods asked me to come on and talk about the old days in Ron Paul's office. I was delighted to do so, of course.
I am delighted to welcome right now an old friend of mine, benefactor, I don't know what else to say, benefactor of the human race, not just of me. And that's, of course, Lou Rockwell, who is founder and chairman of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, who served years ago as chief of staff for Ron Paul, is the executor of the will of Murray Rothbard, has been involved in this thing, fighting this fight for many, many years, and I, for one, am a beneficiary of his many labors in the vineyard. Lou Rockwell, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show.
Tom, great to be with you.
Lou, the Mises Institute is a bit different from other, let's say, free market organizations in that it's not, I wouldn't call it a think tank. I don't like that term anyway, but I certainly wouldn't call the Mises Institute a think tank because it doesn't issue reports pertaining to so-called public policy. In fact, I've even seen you claim that the term public policy, I saw Jeff Deist make the same comment recently, the term public policy has all these statist assumptions wrapped up in it. What's wrong with public policy?
Well, besides all the specifics of public policy that are
right.
Invariably all wrong, the question is, when is it, what public policy asks is, when should the state put its gun against your head and force you to do something? I mean, that's public policy. Should it do it under this particular circumstance or that particular circumstance? Should the U.S. go to war in Iraq? Should the U.S. go to war in Afghanistan? Should the U.S. go to war in both places? So those are the kinds of questions, and they're always very circumscribed. It's always about state action. It's always about the validity and the efficiency and the effectiveness of state action. And so, no, we don't believe in that. We are actually a bunch of free market people at the Mises Institute. That is, we actually think that the market, while nothing human is perfect, the market is so infinitely superior to anything the state does. That is, the voluntary system, so much more superior to the system of violence and the threat of violence, which is what the state is, that things like public policy are entirely legitimate. There shouldn't be public policy. There shouldn't be public in the sense they use it. They use the word public as a synonym for a state. But, of course, public is appropriately another kind of word when we talk about something that's open to the public or groups of people are seeking to accomplish. Then public is a legitimate word, but the state has adopted the word public to mean the state. Public schools, public swimming pool, you know, public park. And you notice it's always something wrong with anything described as public. That's true in spades with public policy.
Lou, I want to make an argument as a devil's advocate and see what you would say. You have been optimistic about the long run prospects for the message of liberty. And I can understand the case for that. And one reason for it would be that we now have avenues of communication that were not available to us before. I mean, anybody in the world can have access to anything ever written by Ludwig von Mises, or they can watch the most recent speech by Lou Rockwell. They can do this with the click of a mouse. And we all know that this is an extraordinary and revolutionary thing, and that, of course, it will disproportionately benefit groups that have been on the outs as compared to the mainstream, because the Keynesians already had a grip on the American public. So the fact that they now have websites, too, isn't going to change anything. But we have had no purchase on the American mind because nobody knew we were there. And now we've got websites and all this stuff. That's all great. And I can see that. But on the other hand, it seems that now that Americans and people around the world have the opportunity to, at the push of a button, read the greatest works ever written on all different subjects. They can take courses on all different things. The vast bulk of them still just basically go to the mall, watch football, get drunk, and go to bed.
Well, you know, I think that's correct. But then the vast majority of people don't actually have an effect on anything. I mean, they obviously have an effect economically. We want their souls saved. I mean, there's, you know, many other things, which everybody is important, of course. But significant social change, I think, is always the result of minority groups. It's always the few either doing something evil, whether we think of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union under Lenin, which was a tiny percentage of the population, and look what they did. And there have been many other wonderful developments from the other side of things. But again, it's a motivated minority. It's an educated and concerned and dedicated minority that brings about good things. So this does, and I am optimistic about the long term, although I must say not about the short term, but this has always been a fight. I mean, in Murray Rothbard's word, this has always been a fight between power and market. I mean, it's been going on for many thousands of years. There certainly have been worse times than now. There have been better times than now. So we're right to be concerned about all the horrendous stuff that's going on thanks to the government in terms of murdering people and all the rest of the wonderful things government does to us. But still there's, here's the most powerful thing. We actually have the truth on our side. And I would argue that whether we look at religion or whether we look at anything else in terms of the human race, the truth eventually triumphs. And I think we're seeing it. Look at the good that Ron Paul has done. You've talked about this, of course, in his campaigns and in his life. The millions of young people he's touched, whose hearts and minds he's changed and inspired. So I think I see this in this country. I see it in many other countries as well. Young people really are sick of the present system. They don't like the wars. They're worried about their economic futures. They're worried about the gigantic, you know, debts for useless degrees they may have from government programs. And they're right to be worried again. But they want something different. They're not satisfied with the present system. And they are dissenters. They're radicals. They're just not willing to put up with what some of the older generations of us have put up with all these years. So I think if we look at the lives of men like Mises and Rothbard, and we see their dedication, obviously very few human beings have that sort of intellectual capacity, but we can emulate their dedication. We can emulate their dedication to the truth. We can try to emulate their courage. And I think the more and more this happens, and I think it is happening more and more, there is a chance for freedom. Now, does that mean we can just sit back and expect it to happen thanks to the internet? You know, of course not. So it requires all of us. Mises was always making this point. It rests on all of us. If, as he said, if society is rushing towards destruction, it's everybody's job to work against that. So on the pessimistic side, of course, we have in the United States the biggest, richest, most powerful, most monstrous, most killing government, I guess, in history. Maybe Stalin was worse. Maybe Mao was worse. Maybe Hitler was worse, but they're all gone. The U.S. is here, and the U.S. has maybe the economic capacity, certainly the ambition to run the world. They want global dominion. In fact, they want dominion over outer space and the moon, and maybe they want the galaxy too, for all we know. But there are problems with bureaucracies like this. They're moral as well as economic and other kinds of problems with the state. So I don't think they can actually get away with it. But it does require all of us to work, to think, to hope, and to educate ourselves and to enter the battle. So everything depends on that. Are we ever going to have a perfectly free society? Are we ever going to, say, get rid of murder, government murder and private murder? You'd like to think so. Certainly that's a very worthy goal, one we should all work towards. But I think we all know there's always going to be murder as long as there's a human race. So, but things can get better. We don't have to put up with this. And I think, so yeah, I am optimistic in the long run.
Lou, last week on my show, one of the things Peter has done for me in exchange for my being a fill-in host is he helped start my own show, the Tom Woods Show, which I do Monday through Friday at tomwoodsradio.com. And last week, quite inadvertently, I wound up doing a Ron Paul week because I had Daniel McAdams at the beginning of the week, and he runs the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, a foreign policy outfit. Then I had Paul Martin Foss, who did monetary policy in Ron Paul's office and who now has his own center. I talked to Norm Singleton, the legislative director for Ron Paul, because at that point I realized, wait, it's all Ron Paul people this week, so I surrender. I'll just do it. And I had Ron himself, and we had a great week. And these people, though, these people all got their start, in a way, working in his office, or at least they got a major start working in his office. And we were commenting on all the people who had gone through his office over the years who had then gone on to do all these wonderful things. And I said, I would love to see a flow chart, a diagram of the Ron Paul empire. And he laughed and said, well, just don't call it an empire, whatever you do. But you worked for him at a very, very different time. You worked at a time when he was still a much, much more obscure figure. He's still saying the same things, but things were quite different in those days. We're talking to Lou Rockwell right now of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. You can check out the Mises Institute at Mises.org. That's M-I-S-E-S.org. Of course, Mises, the great 20th century economist. He is pretty much the only person anybody remembers from NYU in those years, and he was treated as an outcast, and yet he's got an institute named after him, and they all died in obscurity. Anyway, Lou, happier note. Let's talk about Ron, your experiences in Ron Paul's office. I mean, just give us an inside scoop of what the tenor of the office was like. What it was, you must have had interaction with the staffs of other offices. You must have noticed differences between those staffs and your staff.
Well, first of all, of course, Ron's office was staffed by young libertarians for the most part. There were people who were, there for other sorts of skills, computer skills or whatever. But all the people who were interested in ideological questions, and questions of what the government should be doing or was much more importantly not be doing, they're all libertarians. We all worked very long hours. It was a joyous office. I mean, the place was just fun to go to every day. And of course, that's because of Ron, not only because of his principles, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, but what a great guy he is. I mean, he's just a sweet guy. He's a great guy. And that was, I think, the key to the fact that he wasn't entirely shunned in Congress, because he just was a nice guy. Unlike, I might say, the typical guy in Congress is not a nice guy, just the opposite. Also, it helped Ron that he was such a tremendous athlete. He has been all his life. He was the star of the congressional, the Republican baseball team, and the fact that he would swim such huge distances every day in the congressional pool and so quickly. I mean, he was a very impressive, just an impressive athlete. That helped with the, you know, with the other guys. Still, they either were entirely disdainful of his principles or baffled. I mean, people couldn't believe it that he wouldn't, for example, this is unheard of, wouldn't play along with the, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. I mean, this is the way Congress works. I'll vote for your bill, you vote for my bill, you promote this, I'll promote that. He wouldn't do it. He would only do what he thought was right. If he thought it was right, he would do it. You didn't have to lobby him or offer him some kind of a bribe. If he didn't think it was right, it didn't matter. I remember one time, and this was in the evening, and Ron and I were the only ones in the office, and I answered the phone. It's the White House calling. It's President Reagan wants to talk to Dr. Paul. So Chris obviously put him right through. And this is Reagan calling Ron to put the arm on him to agree to the funding of some new horrible bomber. In other words, Reagan, you know, the alleged financial conservative, is of course lobbying for more spending, which was the story, one aspect of the story of the Reagan administration. And it didn't work. I mean, here's the president, a very, very popular president of his own party, and a very likable guy, Reagan, calling up and really putting the pressure on Ron. You know, it was rain off a duck's back. I mean, it had absolutely no effect. Was this true of anybody else up there? I don't believe so. I think Ron Paul is unique in this as in other things. So you had conservatives and liberals who both just despised his views and therefore didn't like him. But there were a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who came to have probably initially a grudging respect and eventually real respect, ungrudging respect, for just this very unusual man who was just so different from all the rest of them and so learned, by the way, because, of course, not only was Ron Paul an expert, obviously he was a physician and many scientific matters, but he was an Austrian economist. I mean, he didn't have a degree in Austrian economics, but he'd done so much reading, so much study. He just understood the Fed. He understood all the effects that government policies were having, whether they were deficits, whether it was the Carter administration or the Reagan administration. I was there during both those administrations. Ron was an expert in what was why they were doing things and what the effects were going to be. Always, of course, deleterious effects. Sometimes he would get preferment or at least, I guess we shouldn't call it preferment, just his just due. The conservatives, for example, tried to keep him off the Gold Commission, which he had a lot to do with starting. And Bob Michael, who was the very liberal Republican leader, put him on for whatever reason. I've always thought that was a great thing that Michael did. And Ron's minority report of the Gold Commission, The Case for Gold, that he wrote with Lou Lehrman, is still a great work. It's still for sale. You can read it for free online at the Mises Institute. We have an inexpensive paperback of it, too. This is just one of many, many things Ron did. But he really, to me, the main thing about him was the example he set. He stuck to his principles, but he did it with great humor, with great decency, with great humility, never in a way that was offensive. Now, sometimes, of course, just being the preacher in the whorehouse, people find that offensive. But decent people don't find that offensive. They may think he's odd. Maybe how come he's not motivated by all the same desires for him and ambitions for power that I myself am motivated by. But decent people came to admire him even very quickly initially. So as to the staffs, I must say the staffs were pretty much a bunch of creeps. These were people who had been high school class president and all their lives had wanted to go into politics for purposes of power, not because they wanted to actually make things better. So they were people who, much less so than the congressman, maybe since the congressman had made it in some sense, maybe they could be a little bit more relaxed. But the staff people, they just didn't get Ron Paul. They didn't like his positions. They thought that there was something wrong with him for not being part of the gang. What was the, they were outraged by these 434-1 votes, which happened all the time. And the reason they were outraged is because if you see a vote that's, say, 400-35, well, okay, it's not particularly interesting. But if you see that one guy has voted against something, one man has said no to something, and of course he became known as Dr. No, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's a bill that seems, or a resolution that seems that obvious everybody should be for it. How come this guy's against it? So that was, people got interested, not only people in his own district, but people all over the country. And Ron, alone among members of the House, especially at that level of seniority, drew financial supporters and ideological supporters from all over the country. And other congressmen and staffers would say it angrily. Other congressmen would say it in a jocular way to him. I get so many calls from my constituents saying, hey, why aren't you more like Ron Paul?
Yeah. No, that's the world I want to live in, Lou. Well, yeah, unfortunately, we're coming up on a hard break, so I appreciate your time. This is our last time on the Peter Schiff Show together, but I hope not the last time you'll be on a show with me. So I'll have you back on the Tom Woods Show sometime soon. Thanks so much for your time, Lou.
Great. Thank you.
That's Lou Rockwell, everybody. Most recent book is Against the State, an Anarcho-Capitalist Manifesto.
Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.